Yeah.
So yeah, I was actually listening to some metal before we started, just so to get myself pumped up.
Nothing
for my
wrong with that.
Encounter with Jason Lockenfora. It's funny, you know, every time we get together, it's like we talk metal, heavy metal, and all the people around us seemingly get annoyed and leave.
Yeah, which is fine.
But screw them, man.
I think that's metal is always going to be polarizing, isn't it? Like, you either get it or you don't. It either kind of like does something for you, or it probably seems like the most childish, like Neanderthal, you know, just silly male thing on the planet. But I don't know. I was raised on it, man, so it'll always have a special place in my heart.
Well, in New York, you know, we were at this nice Mario Batali restaurant, and was going to have a nice meal with my family and my in-laws and stuff, and I ran into Jordan Rudess, the
one that got from Dream Theater?
Keyboardist from Dream Theater. And, you know, I've been around athletes for so long, like, I don't get nervous about that kind of stuff, but when it was him, I was like, oh, should I go talk to him? What should I do? Should I ask him to take a picture? What should I do? I got really nervous all of a sudden. He's like, he's one of my metal heroes. So eventually, I didn't want to disturb him during his dinner. I eventually just happened to kind of cross paths with him right before he left, so I was able to talk to him. But it was funny, when I was talking to him, it was like that nervous, like my voice was kind of shaky the first 30 seconds.
Right.
But it was like, it's the guy from Dream Theater. They're one of my favorite bands of all time. I'm nervous.
No, it's funny that you say that, Josh, because like I've had the same experience. Like I got backstage passes to see Slayer. I have a good buddy of mine owns Metal Blade Records. So he's become a friend of mine, and he, you know, knows everybody. I mean, he literally knows everybody, and especially the guys in Slayer, and they're big football fans. So they were coming to New York one weekend. I want to say it was in November or something. And I was up there for NFL Today, so I get hooked up with these, like, all-access passes and everything, and I'm totally out of my element. And so I brought a buddy of mine who's actually in the music industry. He manages Tommy Stinson, who, you know, is the bassist in GNR and obviously was in the Replacements before, and the Replacements, you know, are reforming and everything, so
yeah.
they did some tours or whatever. So Ben lives in Brooklyn. I'm like, hey, you know, come with me, and I've got, like, a plus one for this backstage thing. And he's a big Packers fan, like a total cheesehead, like makes a pilgrimage out to Wisconsin every year. Ben does, but you know, he's like this hip, you know, New York, Brooklyn guy. I mean, he manages Tommy Stinson, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
So we're there, like we go, like I don't know where to go. You know what I mean? Like if it's any sort of like sports setting, I know where I can go, where I can't, what you can do in the locker room, what you can't. But it's like, I don't know, like these guys are like warming up. Kerry King is like, you know, in just shorts and no shirt, kind of like tuning his guitar, and people are doing shots and stuff, and I kind of like peek my head in, and I'm like being really shy, and he's like, dude, you're legitimately nervous, and I'm like, I am, and I'm like, but Ben, if, like 5 years ago, the Packers are in the Super Bowl, and I'm on the sideline, I'm working at NFL Network at the time, and I'm standing on the sideline and saying hi to Aaron Rodgers and stuff before the game, and it's no big thing, I'm like, you would have crapped your pants, right? He's like, yeah, dude, I can't even comprehend that. And I'm like, yeah, like, to me, like, I don't want to say it's passe, it's very cool, but it's work, you know what I mean? And I'm like, to you, you know, doing shots with Slayer before the show is work, you know, it's kind of like part of your networking schmoozing, but for me, it's like, kind of mind-blowing, you know? So, like, afterwards, like, I hung out with them for a few minutes, and I didn't know, like, you know, it was getting close to showtime, like, I don't know if they need their time to, like, think or whatever. So, like, I got out of there pretty quickly. Like, I, you know, talked to Kerry King about his fantasy team a little bit. We talked about the Raiders. You know, said hi, you know, to a couple other guys in the van, and then we're out of there. And so, like, I heard afterwards, like, hey, you know, Kerry was kind of pissed that you didn't, like, hang out more, like, after the show or whatever. And I'm like, I didn't know what to do, you know what I mean? Like, I already felt like I was just kind of getting in the way, you know?
Yeah.
So it is weird, though, that whole music and sports thing. Like, I've had that experience a lot of times where I'm, like, totally, like, I feel like a 12-year-old kid, you know what I mean, in one of these music settings where I'm just like, oh, my God, I'm blown away. And the sports stuff is just, you know, I've been in professional locker rooms since I was 18 years old. So to me, that's no big deal.
Well, actually, I think the last autograph I ever asked for was I'd seen Mike Patton's band, Mr. Bungle, when I was in college.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm a huge Mike Patton fan. He's my favorite singer,
incredible
musician
vocalist
of all time.
I mean, yeah,
yeah,
so much
vocal
range. I mean, I love his voice. It's
and I waited until, and the show was great, and I was probably 20 or 21 years old, and I waited after the show, and ended up getting his autograph on the ticket stub. And I think that was the last time I ever asked for an autograph, but I was so like proud of it, and I was like, oh, it's so awesome. And then I lost the goddamn thing. I don't know anywhere it is. So I want to, if only I had that autograph for that, the proof that I met Mike Patton. Oh my God,
right.
I can't believe it.
Right. Yeah, no, I definitely get kind of more starstruck, like, through stuff like that. Like, yeah, I mean, but I think that's just because that's still kind of like, there's just a natural fandom that's still there. You know what I mean? In sports, especially when you start to cover it, you know, I mean, it just becomes, you know, a little bit rote, and the whole rooting interest to a large degree, especially in the sports that you're covering, you know, is gone, and you're kind of just focused on the story and doing your job and, you know, making your flight home and that kind of stuff. So it's just such a different dynamic, whereas that whole music thing, I mean, it is an escape still. And you go to a concert, you're not thinking, how would I review this, or, you know, how would I write about it, or how would I tell this story? You're just in the moment and enjoying it, and, you know, you're there to be entertained. So I just think a lot of it's probably our own mentality that we take into it.
Well, and what's interesting too about if you're talking with Kerry King, who's, for those who know, Slayer's guitarist, one of kind of a thrash metal legend, I guess.
He's a metal god. Yeah, I think it's fair to say he's a metal god.
Metal god. But when I was talking to my good friend Jordan Rudess from Dream Theater at the restaurant, he's like, "What are you doing? What are you doing in town?" Because I told him I live in Austin. He's like, "Oh, what are you doing in New York?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm here for the NFL draft. You know, cover it for CBS Sports and that kind of thing." He's like, "Oh, football? Yeah, I have no idea about that." But it's cool that Kerry King was like is into it, because it doesn't seem like a thrash metal guy necessarily would care about sports at all.
No, they were totally into it. And in fact, this was at the time that McGloin was the quarterback, and they'd been on tour, so they were asking me a lot of questions about his last few starts. And they were actually, it was right around Thanksgiving, and they were going to stay in New York because the Raiders, it was the night before Thanksgiving, because they were staying in New York. And I'm like, what do you guys do to get on the bus? And like, no, we're staying in our hotel, because I think we had the game on CBS. Yeah, it was the Raiders at Cowboys. So they're like, no, we're not going to hit the road again until after we watch the Raiders play the Cowboys. So like, we're just going to, you know, party in the hotel, you know, watch the game. But yeah, at the time, you know, they were like debating whether they thought Terrell Pryor or McGloin should be the quarterback. I mean, yeah, and in the 10 or 15 minutes that I was in there, 12 minutes, whatever it was, you know, that I was backstage before the show, you know, I mean, they're like legitimately, you know, they're fairly hardcore Raiders fans. I mean, they had fantasy football teams and the whole nine yards. So, yeah, I think that's probably how it is with a lot of musicians. They're either, like, getting, you know, living out their dreams and getting their yayas out through sports, or they're just, they think it's totally juvenile, you know what I mean? And they've got no time for it whatsoever.
Well, we were talking to Jason Lockanfora. He is the NFL insider for CBS Sports. He works for CBSSports.com. And is on the NFL Today every Sunday during the NFL season. I hope I get that right. It's the
you got it.
Damn company.
No, you're all over it.
I get confused with the Fox show and the NFL Network show.
Bite your tongue.
I know. Formerly NFL Network, formerly Washington Post. We'll get a little bit more into your background, but you know, you have one of the most interesting jobs. I feel like interesting and probably one of the toughest as far as just a guy who just has to grind his way through just so much phone calls and emails and that kind of stuff. What, you know, as one of the NFL insiders, and there's a couple of you guys, because Adam Schefter from ESPN and Jay Glazer from Fox and a couple guys from the NFL Network, but it seems like it's one of the most competitive beats that you could have, just because so much attention is focused on it, on the NFL, and most of the guys who were at the, you know, who are national reporters are in fact really good reporters. You may not feel that way, but you know, they're really top notch guys. So it's like this never ending competition to get scoops.
Oh no,
scoops,
I have a lot
of
respect for. I have a tremendous respect for a lot of guys who do what I do, and frankly, some of them have done it for a lot longer than I have. So, you know, a guy like Chris Mortensen, how he's, I mean, it is a bit of a mental grind. So I mean, his longevity. You know, and his ability to stay that plugged in that long, and I mean, it's a little bit amazing to me. A lot of guys do tremendous work. It is highly competitive. You kind of always have to be plugged in. And there's times where you feel like you're never 100% into whatever you're doing, because whether it's 3% or 5% or at times 85% of your mind and your thoughts, and you know, you're multitasking, you might kind of be mentally somewhere else. But I don't know. I mean, you grapple with it all the time, and it's sort of like a constant struggle, and there's a lot of freedom in it and a lot of autonomy, but it's also, you know, I don't have to be in an office at any particular time or anything like that, but it is a 24/7, 365 news cycle. And I mean, Donovan McNabb gets traded on July the 4th, and I mean, there's just, you know, something huge happens on one of your kids' birthday parties. I mean, so there's a responsibility to always, you know, be on top of things and to kind of always be working as well. So I don't know. The more I've done it, the more I think I've become a little more at peace with it. And I mean, I don't know what works for everybody else. I think everyone's wired differently. Everyone, you know, probably has their own way of doing things. But there are times where I just like, I mean, you don't like shut the phone off, but like there's times where it's just like, you know, I'm going to have my three kids at the playground and that phone will be vibrating in my pocket, but I'm not going to pick it up right now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm just, I'm going to like try to really be in the moment with these guys, you know, or if you're helping coach, you know, my daughter's softball team or whatever, like I'm not going to be that guy, you know, who's on his phone the whole time. Like, I'm just not. But it's difficult. I mean, we're at the pool and we have a little neighborhood pool. We're there pretty much all summer long. I mean, it's like if I get in the water with them, then my phone's too far away, and if the ringer's not loud enough, I don't hear it. I mean, it's those kind of silly, stupid mental calibrations that you're constantly doing. But again, I mean, I'm not. This is an awesome job. It's a tremendous way to earn a living. It's you'll never really hear me complain about it. My dad is like 75. He's, you know, works at the docks at the Port of Baltimore, and he's a stevedore. He's going to have another rotator cuff surgery. He's going to have another knee replaced. I mean, that's work. You know what I mean? Like, right. You know,
that's manly work, for sure.
You go in at 3 a.m., you might come out at, you know, whatever, lunchtime, you know, depending on what time your number's called and whatever. So that's real. I mean, that's real stuff. I mean, this is, this is a blessing. I get to be here. Even if I'm sometimes, I won't say mentally vacant, but even if I'm somewhat preoccupied a bit of the time, I mean, I'm around my kids a lot. I'm in the carpool line, you know, pretty much every day. I may have my phone with me. I may not like be the most chatty guy out in front of school waiting for them to pick my kids up, but I'm there. And, you know, I think that's tremendously important, and I value that. And I don't have to travel nearly as much as I used to, which A, helps you be better at your job because you're not, you know, going through security and shutting your phone off and all that crap, and B, I save every moment of that because I get to be around my kids.
Well, you know, you talk to, I mean, there are certain like baseball beat writers, for instance, who we tallied it up one day how much some of these guys are on the road. And for a guy
who covered crazy.
Like, let's say a guy who covered baseball for 35 years, I think it's somewhere in the range of like he's on the road like for 3 to 5 years of his life, basically doing that. And there are times when you don't see your kids if you're in that position.
Right.
And that's, you know, and I think that would be really, really hard. So it's nice to hear that, you know, that you are trying to avoid like those years of therapy down the road for these guys. But I mean, it is a work. I mean, it's a balance, I guess. It has to be a balance.
It's a constant pendulum. I mean, you sometimes you feel like it gets too out of whack one way or the other. And there's also certain times where I'm like, you know what, I'm being a little too soft. You know what I mean? Like, I need to just tell my wife, like, hey, you know what, as much as I would really like to be able to go do this, I really need to go up to the attic and make phone calls for an hour. And you learn, it ebbs and flows. The more you do it, the more you know, we're in a little bit of a lull period now. So that's when you kind of learn to take your breaks when you can get them and not necessarily kill yourself, because I know come July I won't be around much. I mean, once training camp starts, I'll be traveling a ton, you know, and there's those 6 weeks or so when I'm really kind of, you know, I'll come home every, you know, I'll be gone for 8 or 9 days. I'll come home for a day. I'll be gone for 5, you know, so that's when you're really grinding. So I try to, you know, take advantage of this time in May and June when I can, you know, after the draft.
But how much of an adjustment, you Oh, how much have you had to adapt? Because when you're at the Washington Post, however many years ago that was, covering the Redskins, and there's no such thing as Twitter, and if you break a story, it's your story for the day. And if you miss a phone call, well, you can call them back in an hour or two, and it doesn't make a difference.
Right.
You know, now that's you can't do that, because if you miss an hour, then you could be potentially way, way behind on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
So it's in a bit – you've had to adapt, I guess, in the last, say, 10 years.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt. I mean, without a doubt. I mean, I think it started to really crystallize for me back when I was at the Washington Post and during the whole Sean Taylor situation where, you know, he was in the hospital and there were, you know, it was literally life or death. And, you know, you'd be talking to people down there in Florida, Sean's lawyer, people close to the family, his agent, you know, and you'd be talking at 3:30 in the morning or 5:15 in the morning or whatever it was. And, you know, through the internet and through my blog and then Twitter was kind of just, I mean, this is like, what, 2008 or 2009. So it was kind of, I remember people saying that they were putting my links on Twitter for that stuff in real time, and I just kind of like pretended like I knew what the hell they were talking about, but I didn't even know what they were talking about, but there was a Twitter component to it. I remember hearing that word for the first time and being like, what the hell is that? You know, from my old editor, but trying to play like I knew what she was talking about. So I think that's when it really kind of hit home that, you know, there are people consuming this information literally at any time, day or night, and then the longer you do it, the more you realize that even things you think are totally innocuous and, you know, like things you're almost like, I'm not even going to tweet that. And then you do, and then you come back and it's, you know what I mean? It's taken on a life of its own. Mm. And now you got sports radio talk in that city, you know, all over you to kind of come on and talk about it some more. And it's just like, you just thought it was just like a really barely, you know what I mean? Worthy of even putting it out there. But there is the NFL is such a giant, it's such a monolith that I almost feel like no matter what you put out there, there's going to be some market for it. There's going to be some demand for it, and then there'll be questions coming off of that. And, you know, what does this mean for this guy or that guy or whatever? It's it still does surprise me sometimes just how all in America is on the NFL.
Well, one thing that kind of interests me is because so much of the time you're trying to break news, and even if it's minor stuff, that you know, that small little victory is a victory you can savor, even if it's for 5 minutes. But
right. But
during the week,
which is about the extent of anything you really savor.
Well, yeah,
even
yeah.
5 minutes is a long time these days.
Right. But during the week, I mean, you're doing this Sunday morning show on CBS, and every week you do your segment, and you have to have your news, and you have to have something interesting, you have something exclusive. During that week, how are you figuring out, well, this is something I can hold until Sunday, or this is something I need to go immediately?
It's a constant, you know, it's a constant mental calibration. It's a constant, you just don't know. I mean, a lot of stuff. You just don't know, and people give you your word, you know, that, hey, nobody else is going to have this. But even they don't know sometimes. I mean, there are no secrets in this league. I mean, everything gets out eventually, and there's such demand for it. I mean, Josh, a lot of times you just cross your fingers. You know, and the reality, too, is we go on at, you know, noon, which is pretty late in the game. I mean, some people are doing 5-6 hour pregame shows. They've already been on for forever. So you just don't know. I mean, you try to sometimes be a little more outside the box. You try to think of things where you feel like nobody else is going to be thinking in this direction. And a lot of times you just try to see things before other people. You try to anticipate what you think may become a big story down the road. And then the reality, too, is that these things develop. Like, I mean, 2 years ago, that referee lockout, whatever that, or strike, whatever you want to call it, impasse with the game officials. I mean, that was a weekly, you know what I mean? Like, whatever I get, my 90 seconds or 2 minutes, that was going to be some component of it every week, you know? I mean, there's stuff that just happens that you know everyone's going to kind of weigh in on. I mean, this year, it was the Dolphins stuff, right? I mean, there had to be a good month of the season where there was some weekly component. Like, we weren't going to go through a show and not address that. And more times than not, I would be the person who would try, you know, be, that's my job, to advance the story or keep us on top of it. So he had the whole Jonathan Martin incognito thing. You know, that wasn't going to go away. I mean, it just seems like something like that, you know, always happens, that kind of dominates a certain portion of the schedule. I mean, you know, when you get close to the end of the year, the season, all the coaching stuff will really heat up. First couple of weeks of the season, a lot of guys are still getting extensions. Teams trying to get these guys signed, you know, before we get deep into the season. So, you know, you also kind of know what stories to look for at certain times of the year. There is an ebb and flow to some of this, but you just don't know. I mean, in this day and age, you just don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of times where you feel like you've got something, and then at 2 hours before you go on air, you know, somebody else has it.
It is impressive, though, because I can imagine you writing these stories that we post, I guess, immediately after your hit on CBS, and I can just imagine you writing this saying, God, I hope this, nobody gets this, I hope somebody gets this. But it seems to me, a lot of times nobody does get it, and you are breaking that news. And on the other hand, you know, Jay Glazer, you guys are going head-to-head on Fox, because I have to watch Fox on the Fox show on Sunday mornings, and he's got stuff that nobody else has. So it's like this, there's so much news out there that it seems like sometimes it's enough to go around for everybody to have their own scoops.
Again, I think that just goes back to there's so much demand for this stuff. And you know, frankly, there'll be times where I have a story and I'm like sometimes you feel like you almost have stuff like too early. You know what I mean? Like I can remember like back in October or November, like I had this story like Jon Bon Jovi, you know, he legitimately is trying to buy the Buffalo Bills. And so everybody denies it or whatever. And and obviously Ralph Wilson is still alive at the time. So, like, to me, that was going to be a huge story. And we had it, like, literally, I don't know, 4 months before anyone else. But it's almost like you have it too early. You know what I mean? And now it is a big deal. You read the Buffalo papers every day. And, I mean, it's like, yeah, Jerry Jones at this last owner meeting saying, yeah, you know, I think Bon Jovi would be a great owner. You know, so, I mean, there was a story I did the year before that I'm shocked nobody's picked up on about how the NFL is, like, secretly has all these players wired with full body monitors, and they're keeping track of all this incredible data that will eventually be able to let them play out games on your computer in real time. You'll be able to see how fast that ball was thrown, how high Jimmy Graham leaped, at what angle to catch the ball, what the speed of the ball and the trajectory was when it hit his hand, how many other times he, you know, what the average speed of a pass that hits his hand. You know, all this, like, really, to me, fairly mind-blowing data. And they keep expanding the program, and eventually it's going to be a huge component of fantasy sports and all this other stuff. And, like, I remember when I found out about it, and, like, people at the NFL media were, like, blown away because it was sort of like their top-secret initiative. And, like, that story went nowhere. And, like, now, it's probably still 3 years ahead. You know what I mean? Like, it probably won't be – like, at some point in 2015, when they're ready to wheel this stuff out, people are going to be, like, blown away. But, I mean, basically, you can go back to something I reported in, like, I don't know, November of 2012 or whatever, and it's all right there. So it's just, it's hard to judge, you know what I mean? And somebody else that same week might have had something that I was just like, eh, like everyone kind of already knew that, and I didn't really think to put it out there. And you know what I mean? And that will be something that people glob onto.
Yeah.
And again, there's so much stuff out there, and there's so much demand for it. And everybody sort of has their own opinions and things they care about more than others. And I am definitely intrigued at times, though, as to what stories end up having more legs, you know, at least in the short term than others.
Well, that Bon Jovi story, I think, kind of made a splash when you reported it, and then everybody denied it, and it was like,
yeah.
And reporters, you know, national reporters were kind of going against that grain, and then it kind of got forgotten, and then it, you know, popped its head again recently. And then you're in the position of saying, well, yeah, as I reported 4 months ago, blah, 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 blah. It's like,
yeah,
people
and I mean,
remember.
Even then, even shortly after I reported it, though, a couple of the Canadian papers pretty much, you know, got to people at Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment who were like, yeah, Lewicki and Bon Jovi are in cahoots to try to buy the team. So a few people up there did, like, you know, who a couple of pretty savvy sports business reporters up in Canada, you know, caught on to it pretty quickly, and they were able to confirm it. But, yeah, most people down here in the States were just like, that's the craziest thing we ever heard. I'm like, okay.
But when something like that happens and there are times when people are wrong, or completely wrong, and I can't think of a story where it's happened to you, but I imagine it has.
I mean, it happens, man. It's certainly, I mean, you hope it's very, very, you know, you hope it happens never. It will happen. And you hope when it happens, if it has to happen, that it's not, you didn't erroneously report that someone died. You know what I mean? You didn't erroneously report that someone was suspended. You didn't erroneously report that someone was arrested. You know, you hope you didn't erroneously report that someone was fired. You know, you hope you got a waiver wire transaction wrong, worst case scenario. But it will happen. You do this long enough, it will happen.
And people do not forget, people who are fans on Twitter do not forget about that stuff.
I mean, they should hold us to a very, high standard. I mean, I don't have any issues with that whatsoever.
Let's get into your background a little bit. I mean, obviously, we've talked a little bit about the Washington Post and the NFL Network. NFL, is it NFL.com too, or just NFL Network?
Both, pretty much NFL media across the board.
What did you do? How did you get into the business? What did you do before you got into the Washington Post?
I grew up in Baltimore, we live just outside of Baltimore now, and always wanted to be involved in sports. Loved to write. At one point in my life, I thought I probably wanted to be a play-by-play guy, but writing, my mom really liked to read and write, and I think I kind of got it from her. It was just kind of in my blood. So I went to Syracuse, wrote a ton for the school paper, wrote a ton for the local paper there, the Syracuse Post-Standard, and wrote a ton for a lot of other papers as a freelancer. It's funny because I think back to it all the time. This is like 1992, 1993, like the dark ages. Like there was an internet. Nobody knew what the hell it was. Al Gore hadn't spread the word yet or whatever. So I just remember trying to go into the school library and find listings of newspapers and go through old APSE magazines and try to figure out who the sports editor is in Cornwall, Ontario, and try to get a phone number for him and call him up and say, hey, the Cornwall Aces play the Rochester Americans, in minor league hockey 2 weeks from now on a Friday. Are you sending a staff writer? And if you're not, I'd love to string the game for you. And I just remember sending out paper copies, printing out your resume on really nice stock and spending, a shitload of money to, mail it first class to all these podunk papers in the middle of nowhere, trying to get a job and all that. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I did through college. I ended up interning for a couple of years at the Baltimore Sun, primarily covering baseball, and that was, I couldn't have asked for a better experience. The people I worked with, the editors, it's the people who were around that newsroom, it was fairly stunning. I mean, that Baltimore Sun used to be such an amazing newspaper. And, I mean, at the time, you had Bill Marimo and John Carroll, who a lot of people didn't like, and I had my run-ins occasionally, but had accomplished a lot as newspaper men. You had them as the managing editor and the publisher of the paper. I would look down the hall, and Stephen Hunter would be sitting three seats away from me as an intern, who was our movie reviewer, who went on to the Washington Post, who went on to, write a bunch of movie scripts he wrote Matt Damon starred in. I mean, he's pretty big time. His novels have done tremendously well. J.D. Considine was our pop music critic who went on to do stuff for Spin and The Village Voice and Rolling Stone. Laura Lippman was sitting one section over in Metro. She went on to become a New York Times best-selling author. David Simon would be sitting sometimes listening to the police scanner, and then when the Orioles season was over, when I got hired out of college as a 2-year intern, they wanted me to do half the year on the Metro desk. So, I mean, there'd be times I'd be sitting up there, and the cops reporters would be guys who went on to be, writers of, guys who helped David Simon write episodes of The Wire. Yeah. I mean, it was tremendous. And then, oh, by the way, on the Orioles beat, my mentors were Buster Olney and Ken Rosenthal. So it's like, I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, our NBA writer was Jerry Bembry. He went on to become the first NBA editor at ESPN, the magazine, and I believe he's still there. I mean, it was, you know, it didn't suck. I mean, Mike Litwin was still a columnist there at the time. It was a pretty awesome place to be, and I got to spend most of my time with Buster and Kenny, and they really helped mold me and took a real vested interest in me, and kind of just showed me, let me make some stupid mistakes, you know, gave me enough rope to kind of hang myself at times, and just, again, completely molded me, and I learned a ton from them, and I went on from the Baltimore Sun. I guess I graduated school in 96, was a 2-year intern there, still doing, you know, baseball and Metro. And then I graduated in May, and that following February, I got hired by the Free Press to cover the Red Wings. And I was a huge hockey fan growing up. I played hockey in high school. I always loved hockey. I'm not nearly into it like I used to be. But that was an amazing experience. When I was 22 years old, I get put on the Red Wings beat. They end up winning their first Stanley Cup in 45 years that year. And then they had a terrible accident, you know, 6 days after they won the cup, a million people at the parade, and there was a limo accident, and you know, you had, I mean, it really shook the organization, and Vladimir Konstantinov, who was about as good of a defenseman as there was in the NHL at the time, you know, he was basically in a vegetable-like state, I mean, for the rest of, I mean, he's still alive, but, you know, he was left really unable to function on his own ever again, and the team trainer, Sergei Manatsikhanov, was paralyzed, and Slava Fetisov, an older defenseman, ended up coming back that year, but for a while, people didn't know if he was going to make it. I mean, so you had that all that summer, and then that next year, they went back-to-back Stanley Cups, and I'm still only 23, and I'm like, this is ridiculous. I mean, I'm getting to go all over Canada and the U.S. and cover this team. And I mean, all the Hall of Famers. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, Stevie Eiserman and Nick Lidstrom. And it was amazing. I mean, Scotty Bowman's the coach. I mean, getting hazed by Scotty Bowman. I mean, at the time it sucked, but he's like, who is this kid? 22-year-old kid from Baltimore. Like, what the hell are you doing covering this hockey team? So it was awesome. And went on from the Free Press to the Washington Post. Originally hired to cover hockey there. I did 5 years on the Caps beat, covering largely forgettable, underachieving teams. And then switched over to the Redskins when the second Joe Gibbs era started in 2004. And, you know, once I met my wife and we started talking about kids and stuff, I as much as I loved hockey and everything, the travel was just brutal. And I didn't want to be gone that much. I'd always wanted to cover the NFL. The Redskins were clearly, you know, there's only two beats that really matter at the Washington Post, the White House and the Redskins. And to be able to cover them for 5 years for the paper and start writing some columns towards the end of my time there, it was pretty awesome. And then the NFL Network in 2009 kind of plucked me from the Post when Adam left, when Schefter left NFL Network for ESPN, and then I was there for 3 years, and then I'm going into my third year at CBS.
Cool. When you had made the decision to go to the NFL Network, I mean, a league-owned operation, were there questions in your mind about...
I struggled with it.
Yeah, I mean, there must have been questions in your mind about whether you could...
It was a struggle.
...do your job fully.
Well, and also, 2009, I mean, you flash back to then, I mean, you're getting ready to go into the uncapped year in 2010, and everybody's bracing for labor Armageddon. So it's like, not only am I covering the league for the league, but we're about to have, you know, this full-blown labor strife, and will I have, you know, enough room to breathe to cover that the way I think it needs to be covered? And I mean, they were awesome about it. I mean, there were times when I'm standing in front of the NFL PA building, and the owners are down in Atlanta saying that we've just agreed to a new CBA, and I'm on the NFL's air saying, no, they haven't. They ratified their own agreement. The union hasn't agreed to any of this. The lockout isn't over, and it probably won't end for 3 or 4 more weeks. And they put that on air. And, you know, I don't know what was going on behind closed doors, but not much, you know, got to me about anything. And you know, I was doing my job. So I mean, certainly, you know, going from the Washington Post to a house organ, there were a lot of concerns and a lot of things you just kind of had to sort out. But at the end of the day, you know, the Eric Weinberger, the executive producer there. I mean, I at the end of the day, I really wanted to work for him, and he, you know, he believed in me and was giving me this opportunity, and I thought it'd be great for the family. And, you know, as much as the Washington Post will always be an institution, and the Washington Post, I think, will always be in business and be a beacon of quality journalism, you know, the newspaper industry was and still is, you know, going into a real downturn then, and a spiral, and people were being offered, you know, buyouts, and people were being let go, and, you know, not as much at the Post as some other papers, but it just seemed like a good time to kind of do go into the electronic media, and I'd been dabbling in a lot of local television, and, you know, enjoyed it. So it ended up being a great move, although I definitely miss a lot of people back at the Post, and to have worked there for 10 years was awesome. And it'll all, you know, when I'm sitting there and trying to figure out, you know, do I really have this story? You know, should I send this tweet out? Do I really, 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 really have it? You know, it's George Solomon, my old sports editor at the Washington Post. Like, it's his little voice in my head.
The TV stuff, was that something that you were interested in before you took that job? Like, you knew you were going to get that kind of exposure by doing a lot of TV work?
You mean, was I doing TV work in hopes of something at the NFL Network?
No. When you took the NFL Network job, was TV a bit, was going to be a big part of that job, I guess?
Oh, it was going to be the dominant part, yeah. I mean, I write far more now than I did then. I mean, it's just different there. I mean, like, if you're at the NFL Network and Brett Favre decides he wants to throw to high school kids that day, like, in the middle of the day, and this is before they had NFL AM, you know, when I was there. I mean, in the mornings and you know, there's reruns of Total Access, you know, up until, I don't know, 1 o'clock, and then you've got, you know, top five AFC championship games and all that stuff. So if anything happened that was remotely newsworthy, and sometimes maybe even not newsworthy, a lot of times the thought was, let's just go on air. Like, let's go live, and we'll get Lock and Four and Lombardi or whoever else, and let's do an hour just live off the cuff, you know, because let's be in the moment, which I think absolutely has to be their approach. But sometimes you'd end up sitting downstairs in front of the camera for 4 or 5 hours, you know, because 1 hour would turn into 2 hours. And, I mean, when it comes to, you know, where's Peyton Manning going to land, or, you know, when Chili's waiting for Brett Favre at the airport, I mean, that's going to be your entire day. So you're not really writing, you know what I mean? Like, you literally are in front of your camera, and they could be coming to you this segment, the next segment. You know, people are in your ear. And it also entailed a lot of travel. I mean, a lot of travel back and forth from Baltimore to L.A., which, you know, we got to, you know, it is a grind. I mean, I don't know how some of these guys do it, because it certainly got to be a grind for me. Opportunity to now be at CBS, where I take the train, you know, up on weekends, and I've got the camera in my house the same way the NFL Network camera was, but it's just different. I mean, there's, you know, CBS is a media empire. I mean, I get to do a lot of CBS radio, which I really, really love radio, and that really wasn't a component of the NFL job at all. And I get to write more, which I love, and, you know, we're going to be all over big stories, but, you know, even on the CBS Sports Network, we're not going to, Brett Favre starts throwing the football around, we're not going to, like, not show whatever, the college basketball game that we're supposed to show that night, so that we can do a four-hour Brett Favre special. You know what I mean? Like, that's just not going to happen. But at the NFL Network, where it was NFL 24/7, that would happen. I mean, it would happen quite a bit.
Well, like, I mean, today, for instance, the day we're taping this, it's they're showing their, I guess they have the NFL AM show until noon or 1 o'clock or whatever that is, and they go into their regular programming of top 10, whatever. And they cut in today because it was Aaron Hernandez was doing some court proceedings stuff, and he was there, and they broke in for like half an hour, which is...
Oh, yeah, a lot of times it would be, let's just do a segment, and then it would be like, that was a good segment, let's do another segment, and oh, let's just extend for the hour. Which, and again, I totally get it, and I got it then, and it was awesome because I was, you know, very green TV-wise. So you got so many reps. I mean, there were days where literally you might be on TV for 12 hours. And then through the lockout, I mean, where we're pretty much going live off the cuff for, I don't know, sometimes it had to feel like 16. I mean, there were days where I felt like I got, you know, somewhere, I was in front of a hotel or whatever at 6, 7 a.m., and I feel like we didn't get off air until 10 p.m., and you might do 3 hits some hours, you know, some hours, and maybe, I mean, at least 1 hit every every hour, every 30 minutes. I mean, it just, it, you know, it's like anything else. Repetition is huge. So I really, I tell people all the time, I feel like I did 6 or 7 years of TV in 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, and they just, and it was everything. It's long form pieces. It's, you know, go remote and do a stand up here. It's go, you know, do a sit down. You know, the commissioner finishes his State of the Union address and go interview him for 15 minutes on live TV. And, you know, go sit down with Vincent Jackson when he's holding out and, you know, talk to him. And it was just all different. You know, go do a 3-minute piece here. Go do a 90-second piece here. It was, you know, in that regard, it was an awesome opportunity.
Now you're CBS, going against the likes of, like we talked about before, Adam Schefter and Jay Glazer and Albert Breer from NFL Network and Ian Rappaport and everybody at the NFL Network. How much are you paying attention to those guys? I mean, is, when you're on Twitter, are you following them? How much do you have to be kind of looking over their shoulder versus doing your own work?
I mean, I don't do that. I mean, I follow most of those guys, but I'm not – like, I don't get, like, direct updates when they tweet it. Because it's so, it, you know, Josh, like, with what you do, as soon as somebody puts it out there, we, you know what I mean? Like, somebody, there's an internal email or, you know what I mean? If it's something I don't have, it's not going to take very long before we find out about it at CBS and somebody's, you know, either asking me about it or I've already been chasing it. So I don't know. I just think I would drive myself crazy if like, I was just hitting refresh on their pages all day long. You know, like, I'm trying to do my own thing and follow what interests me. And then if I have to switch over and, you know, pick up off of them or confirm something or try to advance something that they reported, you know, then so be it. But it's not like this stuff happens in a vacuum. You know what I mean? It just seems like it's, the minute it's out there, it immediately, you know, 15 people are retweeted. It's going to show up in your timeline, or it's going to show up in, you know what I mean? It's going to show up in my email. Like, I won't have to look for it. It will find me pretty quickly.
Well, it was amazing because a couple weeks ago we were all at the combine together in New York, and every time I looked over at you, you were on your phone. I was like going to ask you something, or I was going to talk to you about Jordan Rudess from Dream Theater, and you're on your phone texting, you're calling people. It's amazing the amount of time you're on your phone. But you also find yourself in some controversy at the combine, because for the second straight year we decided at CBS that you were gonna send out the draft picks as soon as you got them, whether or not they had been announced or not. And for the most part, they were not. You had them first. And the amount of shit that you took from people, from fans.
I never looked. I was so busy, as you could see. Like, I never once looked at my at mentions, because I'm like, that's just a waste of time. Like, that's not going to help me or do anything for me one way or the other. I'm not going to get caught up in responding to people. I mean, I was upfront about what I was going to do. I don't know. I couldn't have broadcasted any more than I did. And I think there were times where I was probably 15 minutes ahead of some stuff that was announced. That's an eternity in this day and age. I'm sorry. That's like two news cycles in this day and age. So the moment the pick's made, and every GM and every scout and every coach in the league knows the pick's in because it's in their war room. Why the hell wouldn't I want to know? Like, since when has this NFL been about anything other than get the information as fast as humanly possible? Like, that's sort of been the underlying current of this entire conversation, right? So now, because a couple people are putting it on TV, I'm not supposed to do that. Now, look, if the rules change down the road or whatever, so be it. I mean, I want to serve my employer the best I possibly can. That's my goal. And so if we were able to have a huge jump on everybody else on the internet, I think there's a lot of people, I would think the overwhelming majority of people would want to know immediately, what did my team do? Will I want this guy in my fantasy team? Who is Johnny Manziel going to be throwing balls to next year? All that stuff. People want it the other 364 days a year. So, I'm pretty sure our bosses at CBSSports.com were very pleased that we had our draft tracker going in real time. And, you know, the people who are doing the live show, Pete Prisco and Will Brinson, were able to talk about things. You know, they could have already completely dissected a pick, you know, three picks before that pick's announced.
But so, it was still interesting, though, that was a storyline before the draft. Not on CBS, but like Ed Sherman and Richard Deitch from SI, the media critics or media guys who cover the media landscape. It was a story for them that we were going to do it for the second straight year, while the NFL Network and ESPN were forbidden from doing it. So it was still an interest. It was a big story because it was, we were doing something a little bit different.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't really think we're doing anything different. It's just that we're not involved in that TV product. So the people who were, there's going to be certain rules that you're going to follow because you think you've made the determination that this is what's best for our TV product. Now, maybe that paradigm will shift. You know, maybe there'll be more pressure now, not because of me or anything, but just because of the reality of you know, because of commercials and all the things they need to do. Sometimes, I guess, things get pushed back probably more than anyone would like. So I don't know if there's a way on their end to curb it. Or again, you know, I don't know if they're, you know, I don't know if in the future the NFL will you know, and all of its broadcast partners, even ones who aren't televising that particular event, will have a new set of guidelines. But all I've ever done is, you know, operate under the ones I had. When I was at the NFL Network, the first couple of years I was there, there was a push to get the picks as soon as you have them. And then even within those, some of those broadcasts, when you had it, they're already starting to be brushed back, like, oh, temper it. Don't say it like you know it, you know, kind of ouch it a little bit. And then it went to completely, I think the last year I was there, I think in the production meeting, they were just like, hey, Jason and Lombardi, like, you can't even, you know, don't even really tease it too much. Like, we're just not going in that direction. So that's what I, you know, so obviously that's what I did. And then when I got here, there were no, you know, there were no stipulations or, you know, you can do this, you can't do that, what have you. So I, you know, I try to do what I always do, which is break as much news as you possibly can, and especially stuff that's timely. I mean, like, I don't know how many bigger stories there have been in the NFL the last, I don't know, 3 months than Blake Bortles being the third overall pick or Johnny Manziel to the Browns at 22. I mean, that's pretty significant stuff. And if it's 5 minutes before, or 7 minutes before, or 10 minutes before, or 3.5 minutes before, whatever, I don't know. I mean, the reaction I had when I got that first text, you know, BB to JJ, and I'm like, is this guy really telling me that Blake Bortles just got picked by the Jags? You know what I mean? To the point where I even that one, I held off on him for a couple minutes because I'm like, maybe this dude's busting my balls. And I hit up a few other people. I'm like, Bortles to the Jags? And they're like, yeah, it just came through. And another guy, Bortles to the Jags? Yeah, it just came through. And I'm like, okay.
But, you know,
to me, that was pretty freaking significant. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, but it's so interesting that the NFL, if the NFL wants to curtail that, just for the TV product, you know.
Well, no, and I totally understand it. And again, like, if you know what I mean, if CBS doesn't want me to do it in the future, I gladly won't. But if they do, then I obviously, you know, it makes the event a lot more fun. I mean, you feel like you're on the clock the entire time, and it's almost like facing 32 deadlines in one night, you know, that first night. And as an old newspaper guy, I mean, I still get off on that. I mean, it's fun. And it's fun for me too, because nobody knows, and these drafts are impossible to predict. So I like knowing as soon as I do, you know what I mean? So I'm like, most people probably would, I guess.
Well, it's funny, you know, I think right after the first round or sometime in that first round, Deadspin put together like a Storify list of all the tweets about, a lot of them were at you, but we're just complaining about the fact you were doing it. But it then turns out you gained like 12,000 followers that night. So I think the majority of people probably enjoyed what you were doing.
There, you know, as much as some people out there would try to pretend that they're a media scientist or that they can speak for all fans or that just because a certain fringe replied to some, you know, blog question on their website, that they can speak for all NFL fans and what they want. I mean, again, I don't know. My experience covering this league has been overwhelmingly people want to know yesterday. You know what I mean? They want to know 10 days before it happened that it's going to happen. I mean, that the NFL is instantaneous isn't even enough anymore. You know what I mean? People want you to be able to tell them, predict it's going to happen 6 months before it happens. So I don't see why the draft would be that drastically different than everything else.
Well, Jason LaConfora is there to give it to him, formerly of the Washington Post, formerly of the NFL Network, now the NFL Insider on CBS Sports and CBSSports.com. He gets nervous around metal gods, guys, so he's just like the rest of us.
Thanks, man. It's few and far between, though. Trust me, it's not like I'm. Most of the time I'm hanging with the same whack job that I've known my entire life, so it's very rare that I'm hobnobbing with famous people.
Thanks for joining us, man. I appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure, brother. Thanks for having me.